What a gift John and Amy have been to our church already. God has answered our prayers. We're so glad they're here. Yes. What does it feel like to be forgotten? I was thinking about that question this week. It brought back a childhood memory. I was on Adventure Island in Disney World, and there was this boat, and crowds of people were getting on and off the boat, and I was standing there looking around, wondering, where did my mom and dad go? Apparently, my mom thought that my dad had taken me to the bathroom, and my dad didn't realize that was his responsibility, and for a few brief moments, panic ensued as I stood there all alone. I texted my parents this week and asked them, how old was I when you left me on Adventure Island? My dad wrote back and said, just started driving. Now, I would not want to throw my wonderful parents under the bus, so I must confess that about 25 years later, Kate and I were hosting Sundays at the Sundays on Sunday night, and I was leaving church quickly to go get the backyard ready for all the church people to come over, and Kate also left quickly in her own car to get the hot fudge ready, and we were home, and about 20 minutes later, one of the church members showed up at our door with a daughter of ours under her arm saying, did you forget someone? So as they say, it takes a village to raise a child. We can understand that accidents like this happen. But when being forgotten is not just a temporary accident of communication, when it's intentional, when it's a result of neglect, it can leave serious scars on our soul. As we look at the story that we've entered into last week in Exodus chapter 1, we saw that the people of Israel were fruitful and multiplying greatly in the land of Egypt. And this was a sign of God's covenant faithfulness, his faithfulness to his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there was now a king, a Pharaoh, who was threatened by the fruitfulness of the Hebrews. And he responded to that threat by being a threat to them, starting with harsh slavery, moving on to infanticide, and then finally to genocide, wanting to exterminate all the male children. And the chapter left off with these words in Exodus 1, verse 24. Exodus 1, verse 22. Pharaoh then commanded all his people, you must throw every son born of the Hebrews into the Nile, but let every daughter live. Can you imagine how horrifying the fear, the terror that was gripping the hearts and homes of the Israelites at this time? It's not difficult to understand why some of them might have been thinking, has God forgotten us? And to that question, Exodus 2 brings a powerful answer. How do God's people defy despair in times like this when we wonder, has the Lord forgotten us? We're going to see three ways we can fuel our hope in God in times when darkness seems to hide his loving face. And we wonder, are we forgotten? And the first is in verses 1 through 10 of Exodus chapter 2. When we feel forgotten, we can remember how God has delivered his people in the past. This is a wonderful story. I just want us to be refreshed by it together this morning. Look at verse 1 of chapter 2. Now, a man from the family of Levi married a Levite woman. We're not told their names here, but later on in chapter 6, they will be identified as Amram and Jochebed. And as the story of Exodus unfolds, we'll find out that after they got married, they already had a daughter and a son. But the focus here in verse 2 is on the fact that Jochebed is pregnant again, and the timing couldn't be more terrifying. Just think of all the women who lived through China's draconian one-child policy. Now pregnant with their second or third child, trying to hide their pregnancy from the cruel authorities who will not hesitate to execute that policy even up to the moment of birth. And even here, these women are terrified, and Jochebed goes through three trimesters like this with tense wonder. Will it be a girl? Or will it be a boy? We find the answer in verse 2. The woman became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And when she saw that the child was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. It would be hard enough to hide a baby in our suburban communities for 90 days with the ability to close our doors and our windows and turn on the air conditioning. But can you imagine what it was like in the slave community and the cramped and crowded quarters that these people were living under? I mean, with a newborn infant, maybe you get a baby that in those first few weeks is just a quiet child, and all that baby does is eat and sleep and hardly makes a whimper. But by the time they're 3 months old and those lungs have grown, they have the ability to keep a whole neighborhood awake at night. And it's impossible to hide this growing baby boy any longer after 3 months. So what will this faithful mother do? She can't imagine surrendering him to the authorities who would promptly throw him into the river to drown. But it was not only maternal compassion that prompts her brave and compassionate actions. It's the fear of the Lord. Just like we saw with the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah in chapter 1, they feared the Lord, and so does Jochebed. Verse 2 says, she saw that her son was beautiful, or a fine child. And it's the same adjective there that we read in Genesis chapter 1, when God looks over all the works of his creation, and he saw that it was good. And when he created mankind, he saw that it was very good. Jochebed recognizes that her child is created in the image of God and therefore is to be preserved and protected at all costs. So in verse 3, when she could no longer hide him, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with asphalt and pitch. She placed the child in it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. There's great compassion, tender care and devotion at work here in this mother. She's obeying the letter of the law, but she's defying the demonic spirit of the law. And a very special word is used here for the papyrus basket. It's here and in verse 5. And this is the only place in the Old Testament where we see this special word being used, except in Genesis chapters 6 through 9, where we see it over and over and over again. It's the word for ark, where God preserved Noah and his family when the flood of judgment came upon the earth. And likewise, here in this story, God is going to preserve a deliverer, a savior through the waters of judgment in this little ark. Jochebed believes that he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. And she doesn't know how God will preserve and deliver her son from the waters of judgment, but she hopes against hope that this little ark will do for Moses what that much bigger ark did for Noah and his family. And so she carries out the most gut-wrenching decision her mother's heart could make. In defiant faith against the tyranny of fear and the culture of death that Pharaoh is trying to impose, she goes down to that riverbank. That river of blood, as it was called in Egypt. And she carries the ark with her precious son down to the river Nile and gently nestles it in the papyrus reeds, where it will be protected some from the scorching heat of the sun and where it will be least likely to be found by crocodiles. And then she turns and walks away, sobbing, no doubt, with every step. Does she know that her little girl has followed her down there? Has she given special instructions to Moses' sister about what happens next? Or does this young little hero just emerge all on her own in verse 4? Then his sister stood at a distance in order to see what would happen to him. I remember how protective and tender our firstborn daughter was when her little baby brother was born. Can you imagine what it would be like if our government carried out a Holocaust like this one, and you were forced to take your little baby boy down to the banks of the Fox River and leave him there with his big sister looking on from a distance? Heartbreaking sorrow. This won't be the last time in the book of Exodus that Moses' sister Miriam will stand as a key witness to God's deliverance. We're going to meet her again in this book. And one time we're going to meet her on the other side of the Red Sea, now an 80-plus-year-old woman, dancing with her tambourine in hand, leading the women of Israel, saying, "I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously, the horse and the rider he has thrown into the sea." But right here in her childhood, Miriam is being trained to recognize that the story of salvation in the Bible is an Exodus-shaped story. God is catechizing her little soul as a young child, giving her something here to hold on to many, many years later when all hope seems lost, when darkness seems to hide his loving face. And watching what this little girl experiences just reminded me to remember and reflect on all the ways God was at work in my infancy before I was even aware of it, in my young childhood, and in yours as well. Can you think of evidences of grace where God was working when you were a little child, preparing you to know him and to rejoice in him and to trust him many years later? And can you say with me, "Lord, all my life you've been faithful. All my life you've been so, so good." I think Miriam would love to hear the song of William Cooper, "God Moves in a Mysterious Way, His Wonders to Perform." And I think her face would lighten up at the lyrics that say, "Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. God's purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower." Who could have planned or predicted what would happen next? Look at verse 5. Pharaoh's daughter went down to bathe at the Nile while her servant girls walked along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds, sent her slave girl, and took it. And what next? What will the daughter of the murderous king do with this baby boy who has her father's death sentence hanging over its head? Well, mercifully, Pharaoh's daughter has a spirit that is much different from her father's. We read in verse 6, she opened that basket and she saw him, the child, and behold, there he was, a little boy crying. And she felt sorry for him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew boys." And this is where Miriam sees her opening. She's standing at a distance, but now she approaches royalty. And I wonder if her little lips were quivering as she started to speak. But with valiant courage, she speaks up to Pharaoh's daughter, words that will save her brother's life. Let's read the story beginning at verse 7. And his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Should I go and call a Hebrew woman who is nursing to nurse the boy for you?" "Go," Pharaoh's daughter told her. So the girl went and called the boy's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse him for me, and I will pay your wages." So the woman took the boy and nursed him. The Bible is full of delightful ironies, and this is one of the greatest. Who's going to nurse this baby boy? His own mother. And who's making the direct deposits into her account? The very man who ordered that baby boy's death. Through Pharaoh's daughter, this baby boy is going to be protected from Pharaoh's father. And Pharaoh's household is going to pay the expenses. Verse 10, when the child grew older, she, Jochebed, the mother, brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. Another heartbreak, I'm sure. And he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." So while others are drowning, Moses is drawn out of the water. Just as his people will be drawn out of the waters while their enemies drown many years later. And the one who will lead them safely through is named Moshe, which in Hebrew means he draws out. This will become his identity. And in the meantime, little does Pharaoh know that he now has a grandson who belongs to the very people he was trying to make extinct. And this grandson is going to grow up in his own household with a tuition-free education from the finest institutions the ancient world has to offer. He's going to be instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, in the arts, the sciences, the law, the political governance. And he will become mighty in word and deed, all at Pharaoh's expense, so that one day he will be able to stand before Pharaoh's court and prosecute the case for the liberation of his people. Who's really in charge here? Did you notice that the man in charge keeps getting outmaneuvered? And by whom? By Shiphrah and Puah, two Hebrew midwives. I loved how Dan ended the sermon last week. You might feel like your role's pretty small and insignificant, but oh, God is using these small and insignificant people and roles in mighty ways. And he's getting outmaneuvered by Jochebed, the mother of Moses, and by Miriam, Moses' sister, by his own daughter. These women who are powerless politically under the supreme command of Pharaoh are, in the unseen hand of providence, a formidable force that Pharaoh cannot withstand. And this is how God works. This story of Moses being drawn out of the River Nile is a story whose pattern is going to be repeated over and over again throughout the Bible. This is how God has delivered his people in the past, and this is how God delivers his people today. And our lives are woven into the same story, a story where the weak are made strong in the Savior's love, a story where even when we can't see it, he's working, and even when we don't feel it, he's working, and he never stops. He never stops working. So when you feel forgotten, remember how God has delivered his people in the past and realize that your life is a part of that grand narrative. And he's going to do the same for you. And sometimes you'll feel like my life is just being put on hold. What can we do in those cases? That brings us to the second point this morning. When we feel forgotten, we can trust that God is working even while we are waiting. Fast forward 40 years. Moses is rising in power and influence in Pharaoh's palace. He could live comfortably as an Egyptian and just blend in, and no one would know the difference. But Moses knows his real identity. His mother had been doing important teaching and instruction even when she was nursing her child about the God of his father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses sees the oppression his people are suffering under, and he's faced with a choice that Hebrews 11, verse 24, describes like this. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter and chose to suffer with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasure of sin. For he considered reproach for the sake of Christ to be greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, since he was looking ahead to the reward. Moses knew whose he was, the people he belonged to. And the time comes when he says, I cannot sit on the sidelines in silence while God's people, my people, are suffering in slavery. He's closely inspecting what's going on, and he knew that this is a time now when I need to take a stand. Let's read what happens in verses 11 and 12. Years later, we learn in the New Testament, he's 40 years old now. After Moses had grown up, he went out to his own people and observed their forced labor. He's watching closely. And he saw an Egyptian striking a Hebrew very violently, one of his own people. Looking all around and seeing no one, he struck the Egyptian dead and hid him in the sand. I think it would be a rabbit trail for us to do a lot of moralizing here. I think we should go with how Stephen retells this story in Acts 7, where he makes it clear that Moses' heart motive was to visit his brothers, the children of Israel, and when he saw one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. And why did he do it? Stephen says in Acts 7:25, he assumed his people would understand that God would give them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. So this story becomes a foreshadowing of a deliverance that God is going to give through Moses, but the time for that deliverance has not yet come. Let's look at verse 13 and see what happens the next day. He goes out and sees, the word here is behold, this is a surprising sight, two Hebrews are fighting. He asks the one in the wrong, why are you attacking your neighbor? You see, they're not only being oppressed by the Egyptians, they're also oppressing one another. They not only need to be saved from the Egyptians, they need to be saved from themselves. But they're not yet ready to look to God to save them. So look at how they respond to the man God is preparing to be their deliverer in verse 14. The man replies, who made you a commander and judge over us? Are you planning to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? This won't be the last time that Moses feels the stinging rejection of the people God is calling him to lead. And then Moses became afraid and thought, what I did is certainly known. And when Pharaoh heard about this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. This is a desolate desert that he's come to. He's no longer welcome among the Egyptians. He's not welcome among his own people either. So he's forced into another exodus from being a prince of Egypt to being a fugitive in the land of Midian. One man has fled alone into the wilderness to escape certain death in Egypt, just as a whole nation will 40 years later go into that same wilderness to escape certain death in Egypt. And the man who will be called to lead them needs to know his way around that desert. And God's preparing him for that through this. This desert will be his zip code for the next 40 years. Why? Martin Lloyd-Jones said, the worst thing that can happen to a man is to have success before he is ready. So in God's wisdom, this is where God will continue shaping Moses for 40 more years, in ordinary, mundane obscurity. What will his life be like? Not as exciting as it was in the first 40. Look at verses 16 through 22 to see the summary of these 40 years. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then some shepherds arrived and drove them away. And who's watching? Who cares about the oppressed? Moses. This time he handles it a little bit better. He only uses as much force as is necessary to get these shepherds to leave, and he rescues these daughters so that they can water their flock. And they return to their father, Reuel, and he asks, "Why have you come back so quickly today?" And they answered, an Egyptian, they identify Moses not as a Hebrew, but as an Egyptian, rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock. "So where is he?" he asked his daughters. "Why then did you leave the man behind? Invite him to eat dinner." Moses agreed to stay with the man, and he gets a wife that night. The man gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage, and she gave birth to a son whom he named Gershom, which means stranger, alien. For he said, "I've been a resident alien in a foreign land." It's 40 years of shepherding, 40 years of learning that desert backwards and forwards, 40 years of defending vulnerable people, 40 years being a husband and a father. And Moses feels like, "I'm no longer at home in this world. I don't fit in Egypt. I don't fit in with my own people. I'm just out here on the shelf, so to speak." But while he's waiting, God is working. God is shaping and molding his servant into someone who's ready to lead with humility and to give God all the glory. I love this anonymous statement. Anonymous means I don't know who said it, but I think it's a great statement. Moses was 40 years in Egypt learning something. 40 years in the desert learning to be nothing. 40 years in the wilderness proving God to be everything. If you're ever tempted to be impatient with what God's doing in your life, just remember this. God spent 2 years preparing Moses for every 1 year that he used Moses to lead. And his way is often the same in our lives. While we're waiting, God is working. Meanwhile, what's happening back in Egypt? 40 more years of slavery for the Israelites. And that brings us to the climax of this story in verses 23 through 25. When we feel forgotten, we can and we must refuse to give up hope in our God who remembers his covenant forever. That's what this story is calling us to. Look at verse 23. After a long time, the king of Egypt died. And you can imagine the Hebrews thinking, at last he's gone. Maybe a new king's going to treat us less harshly. Maybe this is the time of our freedom. But no. They continued to groan because of their difficult labor. And they cried out. And their cry for help because of the difficult labor ascended to God. Groaning. A natural response to burdens that just won't lift. Shrieking, a natural response to pain and agony. Crying out for rescue. That's the decisive moment when their wordless groaning turns into a prayer and their cry for help ascends to God. When prayer was made, deliverance dawned. I want to ask you, what has you groaning these days? Is there anything in your life that's bringing agony to your soul? Where is your pressure point of pain and suffering? Is there a burden you cannot carry? A problem you cannot fix? A trouble you cannot escape? Is your spirit groaning? And has your groaning turned into a prayer? Have you brought God into the picture? Crying out like we did this morning, "How long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? And when you're crying out like that, what do you believe is in God's heart towards you right now in the middle of your trouble? Does he hear your groaning? Has he forgotten you? Does he see you? Does he know what you're going through? Here's what God wants us to know about his character. It's in verses 24 and 25. Four beautiful verbs. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel. And God knew. I love the way this chapter ends. God knew. Dear friends, God hears you. And there will come a day when all your groaning will turn into dancing. And when you'll be able to say, I sought the Lord, and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him. God hears. God remembers his covenant, not in the sense that he ever forgot it, but in the sense that he never could forget it. He remembers his covenant. He sees. Not for a moment are we out of his sight. Every moment we are under his constant attention and care. We sometimes feel unseen, unheard by people, but God sees and he knows. He knows what we're going through, and he knows why we're going through it, and he knows what he's doing in our lives as we go through it, and he knows how and when he will bring us out from it. He knows. And one day we will know too. We will know fully one day, even as we are fully known by God now. J.I. Packer in Knowing God says this wonderful, comforting statement. One day, we shall see that nothing, literally nothing, which could have increased our eternal happiness has been denied us. And that nothing, literally nothing, that could have reduced that happiness has been left with us. What higher assurance do we want than that? How do we know that's true? We know because we remember the great deliverances that God has already done, culminating in the greatest deliverance of all. Paul talks about it in Galatians 4. When we were children, we were in slavery under the elements of the world. We were in slavery to sin, to the world, to the devil. But when the time came to completion, when the time had fully come at just the right time, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Friends, the salvation that God has accomplished for us in Jesus is our assurance that he will never forget a single promise that he's made to us. No matter how many promises God has made, they are all yes and amen in Jesus Christ. He will fulfill his word. So we can say in the midst of our deepest sorrows, when darkness hides his lovely face, that we rest on his unchanging grace. And what does that song say? It's his oath, his covenant, and his blood that support us in the whelming flood. When all around my soul gives way, he then is all my hope and stay. This week, as I was thinking about this text, I got an email newsletter from John Tyson. And he talked about how during the Napoleonic Wars, In the spring of 1799, there was this small town in Austria called Feldkirch. And it stood on the brink of disaster as Napoleon's troops had swept through all of Europe. And now they come to this little town nestled in this peaceful valley. And the people start seeing Napoleon's troops all throughout the hills around them. And they are terrified. And the leaders of the town called for an emergency council in the wee hours of the morning before dawn. They were panicking. They didn't have the manpower, the military resources to defend themselves. And they're saying, what should we do? Should we resist? Should we beg for mercy? Or should we raise the white flag of surrender? And that's when a godly Lutheran pastor stood up and reminded them of what day it was. He said, this is Easter Sunday. Friends, we have been relying on our own strength, and it has brought us fear and uncertainty. But today is the day of our Lord's resurrection. It is a day of victory. Let us do what we would do on any Easter Sunday. Let us ring the church bells, hold our worship services as usual, and place the fate of our town in God's hands. So that's what they did. They started ringing those bells, and they all went to church and sang, Christ the Lord is risen today. And by the time they got out of church that morning, Napoleon's troops had fled in fear because they were disoriented by all this rejoicing. They thought, surely help must have come to reinforce these people. We thought they were going to resist. We thought they were going to be surrendering to us in terror. Oh boy, they must have a power with them that we can't withstand. And they left. What can you do today to ring the church bells of Christ's victory over your life, over your desolate situation? What can you do to defy the devil and all his lies, to refuse the voice of despair, and demonstrate your hope in the Lord who triumphs over death? Back in 2017, when Kate had her second bout with cancer, I found myself more discouraged than I had been 7 years earlier when it first came. I remember sitting right here, weeping in a Wednesday night prayer meeting when your husband, Ziggy, came and put his arms around me and prayed for me and loved me. And I felt hope just draining. And that's when a friend, Beverly Bullmore, sent us a song that we sing very often here at this church. And this became our way of ringing the church bells of victory over a situation we could not control. When we would drive to proton therapy in Warrenville, we would play this song and sing this together as a way of defying despair. Your plans are still to prosper. You have not forgotten us. You're with us in the fire and the flood. And you're faithful forever, perfect in love, you are sovereign over us. And I'm going to invite us to do the same thing as the worship team comes. Let's just stand together and pray.